So we're off to Malaysia this week, and today's really about when piety gets funky. That might be a very, very strange thing for me to say. Oh, look, let's just get to hearing some of it, shall we? And then we'll talk off the back of it. That's the voice of a Malaysian pop diva called Princess Siti, and she's part of this thing which is Islamist pop music, or perhaps post-Islamist pop music. We will explore in just a moment, and I'll need an expert guide, and luckily I have one in Associate Professor Chris Hudson, who's Associate Professor of Asian Media and Culture at the Global Cities Research Institute at RMIT University in Melbourne. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Waleed.
Is this a big scene?
Yes, it is a big scene. I'm a big fan of Southeast Asian music, particularly dangdut from Indonesia. And I've been studying Southeast Asia for many years.
Right. And so what is the scene that gathers around what we just heard?
I think I'll leave those questions to Dr. Barendrecht. He's in a better position to answer those than I am.
Well, I can see you're very keen to get involved, so let's just do that. And I should... Do you want to do the introduction or shall I?
Yes, I'll do the introduction.
Now, you've got to pronounce your surname correctly.
I
was getting a tutorial before on how to do it, and it'll be a good effort if you can.
Well, I think I can because most people that study Indonesia also have to dabble in Dutch.
All right,
so let's give it a go. Dr. Barendrecht, your current research project is on understanding modernity through popular music in Southeast Asia and the production of nasheed music in Malaysia. Can you tell us what nasheed is?
Oh, wow. And this is your life, incidentally.
This is my life.
Yeah, I know.
I'm collecting cassettes of nasheed. Like I have hundreds back at home, driving people crazy just listening all day to nasheed. But nasheed is actually a very generic term. It means nothing more as raising the voice, singing a song. It may even mean a song. It's an Arab term, as you may hear from the pronunciation. But it was brought to Malaysia, I think, at a very early instance already, and localized, being sung in the Malay language. And there, it got this twist that it was, mixed with popular music. A lot of people were into this kind of nasheed, also were affiliated with the popular music industry at some stage.
Mm. Well, and it's a massive industry now.
It is.
And not just
worldwide,
in Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
And coming out of Turkey, coming out of the Middle East, and out of the West as well. But there have been some unique cases coming out of Malaysia and Indonesia, and Raihan, for example.
Raihan made, I think, nasheed very big. No, that was the first form of contemporary nasheed.
And so we're talking here about religious devotional music, but in a pop music sort of format, aren't we?
It is popular in the sense that it's being played at MTV. These guys perform at rock stadiums. I say guys, most of them are really modeled after boy bands. I think Take That, Boyzone. The audience is mostly girls. They faint, they shout, it's the rock and roll myth invented again, but Islamic flavor, I would say.
It's kind of like an Islamic version of the Beatles, perhaps One Direction.
Mm-hmm.
So socially, what's going on here that drives this sort of meeting of piety and pop? What's the social phenomenon?
The social phenomenon is going quite a while back in time. Like what little people know is that most of these people, Raihan, also other groups, Hijaz, Rabbani, were actually first affiliated to a Islamist movement called Darul Arkam, a movement that in Malaysia was outlawed in 1994. The moment it went underground, nasheed went overground, you may say. And politically they couldn't do anything anymore, so they went into the cultural domain. And there the Islamist message became big, as it were.
But were they underground because there was a hostile political environment?
They basically got a fatwa put on Arkam. So they were not allowed to have any organizational form anymore. They were very big, actually the first to really, if we talk halal economy, to really move into that kind of thing. And it suddenly stopped overnight.
Does this surprise you, Chris? I mean, given that a lot of Islamist politics often seems hostile to pop culture. Does it surprise you that it's instead found a pop culture expression?
No, it doesn't surprise me at all. What I think is interesting about this is the way they're trying to combine both being funky and being Sharia, as Bart calls it, funky and Sharia. So in other words, being pious and cool at the same time. I think what interests a lot of Southeast Asian scholars is the ways in which tradition and modernity combine to create something else that's completely not Western. It may take aspects of Western pop culture, but it also has its own traditional cultures that it reinvents as pop culture. And I think that's where Bart's research is so interesting.
But it is kind of Western, though.
I mean, I would say they use the vocabulary. Hey, look at artists like Sami Yusuf that you may know of.
Yeah, yeah.
A big star. Hey,
so Sami Yusuf is based in Turkey.
He's now in the United Arab Emirates, but he's actually from Tehran, right. Azerbaijani origin. So it's right, one of these new artists with very complicated origin, which has the world as its market. Mm. And basically, the whole Islamic Ummah would be his market.
Mm. He's massive.
He's massive. Huge. Like, he sells millions and millions of records. And yeah, why you say like pop and piety, it's not so strange, of course. Like, nobody forbids Muslims to do dakhwa, to spread their message. And if you could use popular music to do that, why not?
Except
perfect.
There are controversies, of course, over the kind of music and the use of instruments and all of that. I mean, there
even Sami Yusuf.
Someone like Sami Yusuf. So the idea, just to explain some context, is you do have that strand within the Muslim world that doesn't like the idea of instrumental music, that thinks it should be a cappella. Mm-hmm. So no wind, no strings, those sorts of things.
Hence the popularity of nasheed, which is mostly a cappella indeed. Yeah.
And then you've got someone like Sami Yusuf who comes along and he's classically trained, I think, and he's playing pianos and he's...
Yeah, sitar, doof. Yeah.
So how does that work in Southeast Asian society?
What is very interesting that even, like, we call him the biggest Islamic rock star. As I said, like, the world is his market. What you don't see if you just stick to the Southeast Asia market or the Middle Eastern market is that even Sami Yusuf is promoting his records in different ways. For example, his record in the Middle East and the North African region is indeed mostly percussive music. Mm. Whereas in Southeast Asia, he would like take all sorts of forms. Hip-hop is allowed, R&B is allowed. Mm. And, like, it's a lesser... It's not that strict, I would say,
right,
if you enter the Southeast Asia market.
Do you think it's loosened up, Chris?
Oh, I think it has to some extent. I think what's interesting for us to look at too is the ways in which cultural forms come in, not just from the West, but also in Korea. Korean pop culture is very big news in Southeast Asia. So what we like looking at or examining is the ways in which it becomes localised. And that way you can, even if culture hasn't loosened up, and there is still strict religious constraints on art forms, you can somehow negotiate that through reinventing it as it goes.
Yeah, and congratulations on getting through that without mentioning Gangnam Style once.
I didn't mention Gangnam Style once. I was sigh.
And then I went and spoiled it all. That's just ridiculous. It's interesting, though, to look at the fact that this is not just a Southeast Asian phenomenon. I mentioned earlier the Western phenomenon where you have, well, Yusuf Islam, formerly Cat Stevens, was doing this sort of music for a while, and you've got other sort of superstars emerging in the genre, Dawood Wansby Ali, I think, in America, and so on and so forth. Is this just a phenomenon that's sort of akin to Christian rock in the US?
You may say so. It has the same kind of discussions, I would say, attached to it. At the same time, like, you can do other things. It's a bigger commercial business, I would even say. Maybe a bigger market, I don't know. Have this kind of transnational stars that switch, let's say, from the language of Islam, which used to be Arab, and start using English. I would say that's quite a phenomenon.
Mm. And Western musical motifs as well. Yeah.
And the mix of course, not Oriental, Occidental, make a third form out of it.
Yeah. And so, Chris, just finally, where would you say the greater influence is? Is the influence greater from Western society onto these musical forms? Or are these musical forms influencing society more?
I'll leave that question to Bart, the last part of the question. But Southeast Asia has had a long tradition of influence from Arabic music. The popular music in Indonesia called Dangdut is a mixture of Arabic, Western rock and roll, if you like, and various other musical forms. There's that. There's also the big influence I was talking about before from South Korea. But I think that these forms have emerged and then begin to flow out and influence that part of the world. And as Bart said, it's a massive market there, so it's quite a powerful art form.
Mm. But
it's, of course, the ultimate question that normally you get from audience as well, not like, isn't this just simply Western music? And I would say, like, there's more at stake here. Like, I would say what makes it post-Islamist for me is that it's simply not an issue anymore. East versus West, who cares?
So the Islamist Music Project was about expressing some kind of Eastern music.
It was very post-colonial in sentiment, like people still trying to other themselves, like we are not like the West. And for these guys, they are beyond that. Like they don't care. It takes somebody like Mahir Zen, who is like, I would say almost bigger than Allah in Asia. I know like it's the wrong way of putting it. But, people in Southeast Asia like him because he used to be a backing vocal singer with Lady Gaga. Mm. Now he's a Muslim star after he went on pilgrimage. And people simply don't care. Those things fit. They are not a contradiction anymore.
But often what happens in Southeast Asia is you have fatwa or fatwas that are given against, just which are just legal rulings, I should point out, not a death sentence. That's the popularly understood meaning. But yeah, fatwas coming out of Malaysia against things like yoga.
Yeah.
I mean, are you getting those sorts of things being applied to these people?
We played a bit of City Nur Alisa, and that may be a very nice example. Princess City, as you said. Like one of the big issues now in Malaysia when Sami Yusuf did his last album, which only appeared 2 weeks ago, is exactly that. That Sami is singing together with a woman. And isn't the female voice part of the aura? Things that may arouse lust.
That should be, yes.
Yeah, that should be a little bit constrained. Like, it's not yet fatwat, but people are a little bit uneasy about
it. It's a controversy.
Yeah, it is.
I got a feeling they'll bulldoze their way through it and it won't be a controversy as this becomes post-post-Islamist or whatever it is. Look, we're unfortunately out of time, but thank you very much to both of you for coming in. I do appreciate you coming in. It's been wonderful to have you.
Thank you, Wally.
Thank you, Wally.
Associate Professor Chris Hudson, who's at the Asian Media and Culture. That's what she studies and teaches at the Global Cities Research Institute at RMIT. And Dr. Bart Barendrecht. Is that okay?
That's very much okay.
Thank you very much. Anthropologist at Leiden University in the Netherlands.